Jody Kretzmann is lecturing here at Holden Village, and he's now about to start a lecture and discussion on the signs of hope in the cities. And this is session number one, Fireside Room here at Koinonia. So let's go now and tune in on Jody and his listeners.
It's quite astonishing to see so many people inside on a beautiful day here in Holden.
To talk about cities.
Yeah, to talk about cities of all things, right? My name is Jody Kretzmann. This is the first of a couple of sessions that I'd like to ruminate with you about where our cities are these days and what's going on in them, and particularly to think with you about the possibility that there are signs of hope. Watch the cord. I want to give you some more background on some work that we've been up to at the Center for Urban Affairs and Policy Research at Northwestern, where my major base is these days, that has taken us to cities across the United States, where we've collected in neighborhoods from South Central Los Angeles to the South Bronx, to Roxbury in Boston, the east side of Detroit. What we've collected is a whole series of success stories, of stories that in communities facing incredible challenges, stories that are about giving people hope. And they've made us rethink community. And Holden is a place for me which always makes me rethink community. So there is a connection between how we've been sort of encountering life in communities and cities and how one encounters life in community here at Holden Village. I want to get into some of those stories, but I want to start with an ancient story. The Gamraths have to catch a bus in 10 minutes out in front. And since they know a little bit about some of the work we've been doing in cities, what I said was that I wanted to frame this session this morning with one of my favorite ancient stories. So I want to start with a story that sends the Gamraths down the hill with a sense of community. This has become one of our favorite stories about community and about the relationship that we all have. I suspect most of us are part of mobile 1994 North American communities that are constantly sort of sending us off into airports and places that disconnect us from communities. Here's a story, though, that brings me home and reminds me of the power of a place like Holden or what can happen in the South Bronx. This is a story that's out of the Muslim tradition, the Sufi Muslim tradition in particular. I think tomorrow we'll use a Christian story or two, but this is out of the Muslim tradition. The Sufi Muslim story, how many of you know Sufi Muslim stories at all? Do you know them, Ellen? Yeah. They're wonderful, wonderful stories. And one of the things that makes them unique in relationship to the way we tell stories is that the Sufi stories always start with the moral. We sort of lead up to the moral. What did this mean, children, right? This meant that you always obey your parents. Well, in the Sufi Muslim tradition, you start with the moral, so there's no suspense about that. And then the story sort of elaborates on the moral. So here's the story. The moral of the story is, you will only learn what you already know. You will only learn what you already know. Are there teachers in here? Daryl? Is this a humbling thought for a teacher? You will only learn what you already know. Keep that in mind when you're facing students. Here's the story that expounds upon the moral. The village elders had failed time after time to resolve a difficult problem. And so they invited a very wise person from another village to come and help them. And in time she came, and people gathered to hear her wisdom. And when she came, she asked the villagers, "Do you know what I'm going to tell you?" And in unison they responded, "No!" And so the wise woman replied, "You will only learn what you already know. And if you don't know, I'm leaving." And so she left. And the village was in an uproar. And the problems got worse. And the operations staff held meetings. They hired a new director. Months passed and the problems didn't go away. And they debated, and they issued a second invitation to the wise woman, and she came again. But this time, in advance, the leaders of the village had coached the villagers. And when she came this time and she asked them again, "Do you know what I'm going to tell you?" This time the villagers responded in unison, "Yes!" And she looked out at them and she said, "Well, if you already know, then I don't have anything left to tell you. And I'm leaving." So she left. Well, the village became even more frustrated. And after many months, many more meetings here in the fireside room, they invited the wise woman back one more time. And this time they were really prepared. And she came. And once again she asked, "Do you know what I'm going to tell you?" And this time, having been coached, half the villagers shouted, "Yes!" And half the villagers shouted, "No!" at the same time. And the wise woman looked out and said, "Now, will those who know please tell those who don't know? And that way we'll all know." And she left. And she never came back again. And that night, here's a wise woman going, "Let me tell you the moral, one other moral, Alan." That night, the wise woman, who was the leader in the village, had a dream, and she said, "In my dream last night, the message from our wise visitor came clear to me." She said, "What our wise visitor wanted us to know was that any really important knowledge can be derived from our own community and our own traditions and our own cultures, and not from outside experts. We already have the knowledge. We just don't have the confidence to believe that we know." Right? What we have found then, in communities from the South Bronx to South Central Los Angeles with lots of stops in between, is that that story about community wisdom and its power is as true today in 1994 urban America, and I think beyond urban America, as it was 600 years ago when the Sufis began telling this story. So what I want to tell you about is the recovery of community wisdom and community power for the purposes of rebuilding cities. Now you can go. Jim and Alan, bon voyage. Nice to see you. We have found all over the United States, in the most unlikely places, stories that are direct descendants of that Sufi wisdom. We've sort of known, as I think probably lots of you have known, that there are isolated instances of fascinating, wonderful things going on in inner city communities across the country, right? So the idea of going around and collecting these stories, when we got a few resources to do that about 5 years ago, was incredibly intriguing to us. And it's turned out to be an amazing adventure, just filled with moment after moment of deeply moving and hopeful learning. We met our friends on the west side of Chicago at Bethel New Life, a little Lutheran church that had dwindled 15 years ago to 40 people in the middle of an absolutely devastated now African-American community. And that little church of 40 people had to decide whether to pick up and leave or stay. And they debated and prayed about it, finally decided to stay. And once they decided to stay, they said, "If we're going to stay, we'll be effective. We are not going to stay and be an absolute outpost of failure of a larger system. We need to plug in and be effective community builders." And so they started doing some very smart stuff. The first thing they did was to say, "Okay, what have we got?" And what they had was a mortgage-free church building. So what they promptly did was to remortgage it for the first time. They've now done it 6 more times. And with that first remortgaging, they bought a dilapidated 3-flat down the block And every Sunday after church services, for the first 6 months, most of the 40 people at church went down the block and spent the afternoon and the evening rehabbing that building. And after 6 months, they had it done. And they got tenants in. They got a little flow of money going there. They bought another one. Well, this has gone on now for 15 years. And Bethel New Life, as they're now called, is a $10 million a year operation, which hires 650 people, has a staff of 650 people, runs 22 businesses in that community, is the second largest employer on the west side of Chicago, has rehabbed over 1,300 units of low-income, affordable housing for folks in that neighborhood, and is generally a kind of beacon of hope in a community that didn't have a whole lot of hope. It's a story that's well known not only in Lutheran circles, but increasingly in community building circles across the United States, both religious and secular. There are more and more stories like that. Some of you know Newark, New Jersey, where a scruffy Catholic priest, right, about 12 years ago, began meeting with some folks in Newark and deciding that it was probably not going to happen if you keep waiting for the new auto plant to descend into Newark, or you keep waiting for Washington, D.C. to do something to rebuild Newark, and that they had to do it based on what they had. And they've put together now a powerful economic development engine which operates at about $100 million a year, has three separate shopping centers, employs over 2,000 people, has done over 2,500 units of housing, and is an amazing sort of substitution, if you will, for civic and governmental life in Newark. Is that accurate? And in Boston, in the Roxbury community, in the Dudley Street section of the Roxbury community, which is the poorest section of Boston, in a community that's about 50% African American, 25% Latino, 25% Cape Verdean, a little planning group of local citizens got together about 9 years ago and started saying, everybody in this town has plans for our community except us, because they're close to downtown Boston. And if we want to take back our community, we need to have a community plan. And so they took their time, and they gathered local folks, and they had block by block by block meetings in which they put together a marvelous, integrated, fully sort of articulated community plan. And the power of that plan, put together by the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative in Roxbury, was such that that neighborhood became the first neighborhood in the United States to get from city government, Boston city government, the right of eminent domain. So they now control the 30% of the land in that neighborhood that's vacant. Not the city of Boston, they, this scruffy little neighborhood group. And they've begun then to be able to control the future of their community. These are some of the big ones. There are lots more big ones. 600,000 units of low-income housing in the last 10 years, as the federal government has gotten out of that business, has been created by local community development groups across the United States. An increasingly powerful, effective, and skilled network of local people who have figured out that the answer isn't going to come from Washington, probably not from the State House, and probably not from City Hall, and probably not from any place except themselves to begin with. We were as interested, though, in the smaller stuff. You didn't have to have 7 or 8 figure numbers behind these projects, it seemed to us, to capture what it is we were looking for. So we were just as interested in the block-by-block efforts in every city that I visited to redefine community safety as our question, not the police. Not the police's question, our question. We were interested in the now scores of public housing developments across the United States, where residents of public housing, marginalized economically, ghettoized often in dilapidated and underfunded developments, are taking over those developments themselves, so that the movement towards what's called resident management councils has become a powerful network of movements of mostly women in public housing who have decided, this is our community. This is what we've got. And we will manage it, and we will, in fact, turn it into livable homes for families. So you can, now, unlike 5 years ago, you can go into, in some large cities, some isolated public housing developments, or even single high-rises within larger developments, and you can experience public housing as bright, open, family-friendly, clearly run by powerful resident groups who are awfully impressive in their capacity to define community norms in a new way. Hundreds and hundreds of stories like this. And what we've done then is to think about these stories with community leaders and say, what are the themes? If you put these stories next to each other and you started thinking about what can they teach us, what would we learn? How could we listen to these stories with an eye toward helping this community building process grow even further? And we've collected a bunch of those stories and the lessons, at least as far as we sort of know them now, and this is sort of pretty tentative work in a book that came out a couple months ago called Building Communities from the Inside Out. And I wish, Ted, that we had a number of copies of this, but unfortunately the first printing of it sold out faster than we had expected. And so the second printing should be out in a week or two. But I do have, if people are interested in that, there are ways to get it here too. So what I want to do briefly then in the next little bit and then open it up to some discussion, I hope, is to think with you about what I now think is the central lesson when we think about these stories. And Ted, it certainly relates to some of the work that you're doing internationally and to some of the themes that I think, Daryl, you'll be talking about this week as well. When we talk to folks in the South Bronx, South Central Los Angeles, the west side of Chicago, inner city San Antonio, they told us a similar set of stories. When we would ask them, what happened here? What's your explanation for what happened in the South Bronx? Why does the South Bronx look the way it does? Why is it devastated, empty, rubble? We often got wise and experienced answers. And if we had to boil them down to three things, I think I can report that people mostly said, number one, what you're looking at here is a community that has been unplugged from an increasingly global economy. That the economic rug has been pulled out from under this community, if we're looking at the South Bronx or the west side of Chicago. That these used to be communities that had access to pretty well-paying industrial jobs. The kind of jobs that you could get without a high school education, with just the willingness to work. And you could go into those jobs, whether they're in the mills or in auto, other industrial sectors, and you could begin to get a stake in community. You could buy a home, you could begin to imagine a future for your children, who would then be more educated than you. But they were rungs on a ladder, if you will, rungs on a ladder of opportunity. And those rungs aren't functional in lots of communities now. Well, you know that, and we knew that. We just heard it over and over again. I know it in my town of Chicago because we've lost 400,000 of these kinds of industrial jobs over the last 20 years. 400,000 of the kinds of jobs where folks could begin to get a stake in community and community building are gone. And every city that you know about is affected to some degree by that process. The second thing we heard was not only has the private sector, for all kinds of reasons, withdrawn the opportunity to work, but all kinds of other institutions that used to be at the center of our communities are either gone or weakened, right? Think of the churches that have closed and left. In my own town, I think about the dozen hospitals, 12 hospitals that we've lost in low-income communities over the last 10 years. Think of the shape that a lot of our public institutions are in, whether they're schools or parks or libraries or police, almost all functioning less effectively than they did 15 or 20 years ago as funds have been withdrawn. So that was the second thing we heard. After the economy, the institutional base of communities get withdrawn. But it is the third thing that we kept hearing over and over again that began for us to give a kind of central theme to the community building successes that we were seeing. And I want to just spend a moment with you on this third thing, and maybe do it in a kind of simple-minded way. The stories we began hearing over and over and over again were stories about, as one friend in the South Bronx put it, invisible prison walls. That there's a feeling in communities of cut-offness that is deeper than being cut off from the economy or institutional life. And one woman who's become a good friend in the South Bronx put it, I think, most graphically to us first about 4 years ago. And she said that this whole community now is a prison. But the walls around this community are not walls that are made up of bricks and mortar and visible and tangible materials. They are walls that are made up of people's ideas about who we are, she said to us. People's ideas about who we are here in the South Bronx. And she said, I can't go any place else in the other four boroughs of New York or in suburban New Jersey or Connecticut and even say the words South Bronx without immediately a kind of fog descending in front of people's brains, a kind of a set of images immediately that she said cuts off all further discussion. Right? Now when I say South Bronx, I'll bet it works for you too. Do you begin to get a set of images? Mm-hmm. What does South Bronx mean? Let's shout some of them out.
War zone.
War zone, right. But Fort Apache, the Bronx, right?
Yeah.
The
drugs.
Drugs.
Rundown.
Rundown, abandoned buildings.
One of the few places rundown more than Newark.
Yeah, that's right. Next to which Newark looks great, huh? Yeah. I mean, we could go on and on. We started playing with these images and thinking about
the war.
Yeah. We started thinking about these images, and one of the ways we started playing with it is to say, it's like people have in front of their eyes and heads a map. It's like this neighborhood needs map. And when you say the word South Bronx, this map, which is a set of images, descends in front of people's heads and determines what then gets said. And it's a map that has on it broken families and slum housing and graffiti and mental disability and crime and welfare recipients and gangs and dropouts. This is not the whole list. This is just the beginning list. This is not any sort of scientific or quantifiable map. This is a map that's about a set of images. It's about a way of thinking. And I want to just think with you about this map for a second, because I now think that our friend in the South Bronx was onto something. And that, in fact, she was describing what has become, perhaps, ironically enough, a kind of well-intentioned American version of apartheid, in which we have labeled individuals and entire communities with an unrelenting and powerful set of images that are all about needs and problems and deficiencies and emptinesses, right? That's what this is about, and I want to think about that process for just a second. And I want to think about this map and its power. What I want to say first about this map is that the problem with this map in relationship to the communities that I know and work in is not that it is untrue. This is a true map. The problem with it is that it's not complete. it is not the whole story, right? So let me think with you for a moment about this map. Its nature, its origins, and its consequences. First, just a word about its nature. And Gertrude, let me get really simple-minded here about community. You're our expert on community. And this is where Holden comes in. It seems to me absolutely clear that everybody in this room, let me use a simple prop here, is like this glass of water. Coffee, it's actually coffee. We are all people, we Lutherans know this, saints and sinners, full and empty. We are all people who have fullnesses and emptinesses about us, who on the one hand have gifts and capacities and skills and resources, and on the other hand, all of us, I think, in this room, have needs, problems, and deficiencies, right? All of us do. I sometimes talk about my colleagues at Northwestern University, but I could talk about friends that I know in here pretty well too, Chuck, Ted, Gertrude. But let me talk about my friends at Northwestern, professors at Northwestern University, which is a pretty good school. 24 of them, Center for Urban Affairs, largest urban research center in the United States attached to a private university. Those 24 professors at Northwestern are the most needy, problematic, empty, deficient people I could imagine. They are people, my colleagues at Northwestern, who can't keep a marriage together, whose children don't speak to them, lots of them. Some of them drink too much. Some of them have done drugs. Some of them get so depressed for periods of time that they can't work. These are my colleagues at Northwestern. You may want to think twice about sending your children to Northwestern. Except that it's true of every other place. Right, but what is the kicker here, right? I mean, you understand that when people at the Center for Urban Affairs come to work at 8 o'clock in the morning, or sometimes a little later, what they come with is not their needs and their problems and their deficiencies. They are not expected to show up and to run an ongoing, never-ending therapy group. They could, absolutely they could, and they could keep counselors and helpers and professionals busy for years, treating them, filling up their emptiness. But instead, they are asked to bring their gifts, their skill as teachers, writers, researchers, formulators of interesting questions, some of the time, about cities. All I'm suggesting is what we all already know, that every working organization, and certainly every community that has ever been built, is always, always built on the gifts, skills, and resources of people who are also highly deficient and needy and problematic. I think that's true of every organization and community that I've ever been a part of. It's certainly true of Holden when Holden's working well. This is a place that gathers the gifts and the skills and the resources of people.
Every local church.
Every local church.
Parish.
Exactly, Chuck. So what's wrong with this map? This is a map which denies the reality that we know so well holds true for us and our communities, and which defines whole populations as if their emptiness were all they were. Empty people are called recipients or clients. Empty people are people who need filling up from the outside. Full people are people who are called, in public life, citizens. And they are people who build community. This is a dependent client community. Dependent and client community can ever rebuild. So that's a word about the nature of this map. Now let me just say a word about the origins of this map. Nothing could be clearer to me after the odyssey that we've been on really for the last 25 years, but for the last 5 years specifically. Nothing could be clearer to me that my friends in the South Bronx didn't draw this map about themselves. This is not a map that was created by my friends in public housing or in the west side of Chicago. This is a map that was created, I now think, by some of the most powerful central institutions in our culture, in our society. Let me think with you for just a second about where this map comes from. Where the idea that emptiness is the central definitional reality here, where that comes from. Let me just suggest a few candidates. Let me put at the top of the list my own institution, the university. I think universities, particularly social sciences, my own doctorate, social sciences, particularly those that are concentrated on questions of poverty and cities, have increasingly become a place where the central task is the quantification of misery. Right? That you count up the problems and you figure out how it is that a variety of increasingly sophisticated quantifying tools like regression analyses could be run on these problems, and you feed them into the modern icon, the computer, and they come out reified. They become the central definers then of what the reality is when we think about public housing or the South Bronx. So let me do a mea culpa and put my own institution right at the top. But I'm not alone. I think the funding community, the philanthropic community, foundations, the United Way, also play an ongoing central role in developing the kind of dance that always goes on between people with resources and people with fewer resources. So that the definition, for instance, of the United Way and the foundation community in relationship to these kinds of communities, the South Bronxes of the world, is always premised, or usually premised, on a tool that has been developed for opening the discussion. And that tool is called a needs survey. That every time a needs survey is asked for, what's happening is that somebody with resources is asking somebody who has fewer resources to draw this map about themselves. Tell us how empty, deficient, and problematic and needy you are, and we will give you money. Right? Let me just say, as somebody who sits on the board of a foundation and in fact reviews a lot of proposals from communities, I have not, in the last 10 years, learned anything from any needs survey that I have read. You tell me the community in a city I know well, like Chicago, you tell me the community and I can do the needs survey myself. Let me just crank it out. So why do we ask people to do that? What's the dance about here?
Control.
Yeah, I think so. And then, Tom?
Also, these institutions recognize their own emptiness.
Huh. And this is a way of filling it up? Is there a need to be needed?
I'm saying that they're looking at other people's emptiness, but do they look at their glass objectively as well?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good question. There's certainly, I think, an increasing recognition on the part of some of these folks that what we've been doing isn't working, which may be a way of saying, let's take a look at being full in another way, not quite confessing emptiness. Let me add a couple more suspects in terms of who draws this map. Government Human Service Programs, while they're not very creative or inventive themselves, they sort of follow along university research, they follow along philanthropic research, and they sort of fund, you know, billions of dollars goes into the maintenance of this map. That's what this map is about. It funnels lots and lots of public resources. I would also say the mass media are absolutely addicted to this map. I don't know how it is in your own cities, but in Chicago, we have we have media that are absolutely clear that the only story out of these communities that's interesting is one which is the most spectacular instance, right, of this map. Yeah. Well, you don't have to beat that one in. Then I wonder about churches. I wonder about the religious community in relationship to the creation of this map. I wonder about the institutionalization, if you will, of the need to be needed. Whether that's part of seminary education, whether there's an ethos of helping, which is really about power, and not quite so much about being helpful. Well, that's a word or two about the origins, and let me just say then a word about the consequences of the map. Yes, leap in.
As I see this, what comes to my mind is sort of a healing process that goes through the individual, and that you need to hit the bottom sometimes before you
Interesting.
Recover. And that you need to, the community needs to look at itself in this way to be able to heal. Right? Hmm. Until they realize they have the problem, they will not heal. And that's why when you started talking, the feeling that was going through my mind is that Bronx and Newark or other places are really better off than some communities that we come from where we don't realize.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's certainly clear in the communities that I work in, which are mostly low-income communities in cities, that nobody there is under the illusion that everything's working. and you're saying that may in fact be a head start, and you may in fact. I think that's one of the reasons why I find myself learning so much from those communities, right? That they really are reinventing from a point of view that's quite basic. I want to just think for a second then about the consequences of this map. One of the worst, it seems to me, is that although this map is not created by people in local communities, sometimes they begin to believe it about themselves. They internalize the idea that this is what we are, that we are nothing but needs and problems and deficiencies here, and that's who I am, and that's who my neighbors are, and therefore we can't do anything. And that is a major hurdle once that's pervasive in a community. And it's one of the things that leadership is most clearly about, is getting over that. A word then about leadership. This is a map, I think, that makes local community leaders in low-income communities and cities absolutely understandably schizophrenic.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, I'm a leader in my community, right? If I can attract resources. I attract resources by drawing an absolutely compelling picture of emptiness, right? Of convincing funders and the government that my gang problem is worse than any place else in Chicago, and that my teen pregnancy rate is higher than anybody else's in Chicago, so fund me, right? And then I have to turn around after starting my day by reinforcing my leadership credentials, by denigrating my neighbors, if you will, right? I have to turn around and be a leader of people that I just said have nothing to contribute. And so we wonder then why neighborhood leaders burn out and find it difficult to dance those two dances, because they're absolutely contradictory dances to dance, it seems to me. One's a waltz and one's a jitterbug or something, but you can't do them at the same time, right? This is also a map, obviously, that fragments our responses to problems. Money goes into this map by these categories, right? Another way that we were sort of playing with the images here is that each of these categories could be the title of a grant proposal, right? And you could get it funded, depending on what the fad of the year was, right, and what was getting funded in that particular year. What does that do? It denies the basic community wisdom that insofar as these problems are all true, they're all interconnected. They're all interconnected. You can't touch one without the whole web reverberating. And it also, I think, denies what a lot of community folks know, that these problems are in fact symptomatic of something deeper, and it has to do with sort of the economic and civic power of the community to solve problems itself. These are sort of symptoms of something that's much deeper and much broader, right? This is also a map, it seems to me, that determines clearly how resources flow, dollars, money. We did a little study about 8 years ago in Chicago, trying to figure out how much money was going into the community targeted in some way to poor people, right? And we were very conservative in counting the dollars. We didn't count a whole lot of education money, criminal justice money, we didn't count. But even being conservative, public dollars targeted to poor people, $25,000 per family of four, per low income. At that point, the poverty line was about 12. $25,000 per family of four was coming into Cook County per poor family of four, right? But you know what's happened, right? I mean, you know the kicker to this, probably, right? That about $7,000 of that $25,000 actually went to low-income folks. Mm-hmm.
The rest went to salaries for people.
Absolutely. $18,000, the other $18,000 went to helpers. Right? Went to the professionals. And 50% of that went to the healthcare system. Some of our more cynical friends now on the west side of Chicago say, you know, it only takes one good poor neighborhood to support two good middle class ones.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is a set of employment programs, and it doesn't have a whole lot to do with the intention of a lot of the law, which is in fact to help eliminate poverty. Right? This is also, let me just say a couple other things about this map. And this is all stuff we're sort of learning as we're doing stuff with community folks. This is a map that is militantly focused on the individual. On the individual. And on the survival of the individual. And not at all on anything like community development. Even though people sometimes use community development language to explain what this map is about. It's not about that. At most, it's about individual survival. And we deceive ourselves if we think that this can be about anything else. I have nothing myself against survival, by the way. I think it's very important. And without it, not much else can happen. But we do deceive ourselves if we think that dollars spent in this way is about community development. It's not. This is a map that, in fact, deepens dependency. Year after year, I have to convince you that my crime rate, in fact, despite our best efforts, is worse this year if I want your money. It rewards failure. And I think now, too, and this has become an important insight we've picked up from computing, this is a map that is a relationship buster. If I'm on public aid, or if I'm a community development leader who's dependent on outside funds entirely, my most important relationships are to my welfare worker, or to my probation officer, court officer, to my funder. And my most important relationships are no longer to family, extended family, folks on the block. I don't look to my neighbors to solve problems. I look first to City Hall, or to the court system, or to my welfare worker. So that the relationships that make up local problem-solving power begin to wither away and weaken from disuse. People don't use them. Because first of all, this map says your relationships to the outside are most important. And the final thing I think I want to say about this map, we could probably go on about it, I do think this is a powerful, powerful map. It determines how billions and billions of dollars are spent, and I think now it determines the sort of high level of hopelessness that lots of people have about the prospect of anything effective ever being done in relationship to the South Bronxes of the world. I don't think we believe anymore, many of us, that effective work can happen, that real community building, real community development work can happen, real change can happen. And it's because this map has monopolized our imagination. And I mean hopelessness here, from the kid on the street corner to the White House. If I'm a kid on a street, and this is what I think I'm living in, I've got no reason to invest in myself, in my future, in this community. I might as well take the short-term drug money, or whatever presents itself, right? And if I'm Bill Clinton, and this is what I think of when I think South Bronx, it's going to take a lot to persuade me to put more resources in there, because nothing's going to change. This is an endless and ever-deepening pit. down which we can throw resources forever and nothing happens. So, I think there's a visceral and increasingly sophisticated understanding of the limitations of this way of going about problem solving in urban America. And therefore, the good news is that in hundreds of communities across the United States, people have said the first thing we need to do if we're serious about rebuilding this community is throw this thing out and act as if that's not the primary truth about who we are. And what they've been doing then is constructing an alternative map. It's saying, if we change our glasses and we look around us once again, we can see that even in the most devastated communities, we are places that are filled with the things that communities are always built from. The gifts of individuals, the power of local citizens' associations, including churches, to mobilize those gifts, and the latent power, when recaptured for local community building processes, of local institutions. So most of the 380 pages of this book, got a little longer than we thought it was, is about how people are taking this map and beginning to rediscover the power that's right in front of us all the time. A couple of premises that they have retaught us about individuals and associations and institutions, and then I'll stop and I want to get some reactions. Premise number one, everybody in this community has a gift. And premise number two in that inner circle, everybody's gift in this community is going to get given. Right? You can't escape the obligation to give your gift. And we've been particularly interested in communities that have found the giftedness of people who have been traditionally regarded or diagnosed as empty. Right? Empty because they're too young, or empty because they're too old, or empty because they're facing a variety of developmental disabilities, or empty because they've just gotten out of jail, or because they're fighting drug and alcohol addiction. These are all diagnoses, which is what institutions do to people to convince them of their emptiness. Community builders understand that everybody is gifted and figure out ways to get the gifts given. Second set of lessons has to do with citizens' associations. That neglected space in the United States, that space that is between huge institutions and each of us as individuals, the space where people come and do things together without pay. So the sort of simple-minded distinction we always want to make between what's an institution and what's an association. An association is where people come together and do stuff without pay. Right? And institutions are where we get paid to do the stuff. And they're very different. The character of them is very different. What they can do in relationship to community building is very different. Our lessons in terms of associations have to do with also two major pieces of constantly reinforced data. One, there's always more associational life than you know about in a community. There's always more there than we know about. Lots of stories about that. And secondly, the associations that are in a community will always do more, or often do more than they're ever asked to do, if you ask them. If you ask, they can be stretched. Right? Finally, on the institutional front, every community has, or some combination of schools and libraries and parks and hospitals and businesses and community colleges. But often, they are outposts of larger systems. Institutions are sort of particularizations of larger systems and take their signals from larger systems. The trick to community building is recapturing institutions, surrounding them, if you will, with community agenda that says, This school is no longer just answerable to the downtown Board of Education. This school is a community building institution that has a building that ought to be open for 24 hours a day, that ought to be relating to adults and elderly folks in the neighborhood and kids. This school is a place that's got a budget. They ought to be hiring locally. They ought to be purchasing locally. This school is a place that brings together all the networks of the neighborhood. This school ought to be at the center of a community building process. And the same is true of every congregation, and the same is true of every library, and the same is true of every local park. So the final image I want to give you is of a series of institutions, like churches, that are all connected with everything else in the neighborhood. Local, these are local connections that are being rebuilt, that are about a church relating to local artists, the local school, the tenants organization, the cops, the daycare center. All about local problem solving. And if the church does that in the neighborhood, so can the park, and so can the school, and so can the local library. And what you begin to get is this kind of an incredibly messy overhead. This is about democratic community building, where the networks of local problem-solving relationships are so dense that you can hardly feel your way through them, right? This is about a neighborhood that has said, we are no longer an object of charity here in the west side of Chicago. We no longer go to City Hall with our hand out like this, or to the ELCA with our hand out like this, or to the feds, or to the banks downtown. We instead are a neighborhood that doesn't necessarily have everything we need, but everything we've got, we've found, we've connected to each other, and we've mobilized for local problem solving. And now when we go for outside help, because we still need it, we always go this way. And it's about partnership, and it's about investment. And in fact, City Hall and banks and ELCA, if you invest in us in this kind of neighborhood, you'll get a return, right? Because we know who we are, we've mobilized it all, and we're going forward. This is a map that's about citizenship, then. This is a map that's not about emptiness and clienthood. And I think that the construction of this set of relationships and this dynamic is going on in cities across the United States. And in fact, may, as we're working over the next decade, may be the seeds on which a total reinvention of what a city is happening. The limits of how to govern a city, the limits of the major institutions are becoming more and more evident. That all over the globe, private corporations are trying to flatten, right? Demingize, push decision-making down. Governments are reinventing themselves. Clinton and Gore are big on this. Means flattening decision-making, pushing it out there. This is a question of what can we build at the community to meet that flattening stuff. Right? Can we build, once again, the capacity of local citizens to say, there are a whole lot of problems that are inappropriate for big institutions to solve. And we know now what the limits about those are. And is there a way then for us to rethink our own capacity and our own power? So this is, I think, an incredibly hopeful moment in the development of urban America. And there's an emerging clarity here that has a lot to do with what we know about community here at Holden and about how to in fact rediscover the power of citizens to build community. Let me stop there. And what I've done is a sort of overview of what we've been thinking about here. I want to get some reactions to that. I want to go into some more detail on it probably tomorrow as well. Yeah.
I'm just curious. Do you see any danger in this of, what's the word, vigilantism or whatever, a community group maybe getting a charismatic leader? I've seen that in Oakland, where they sort of take over the community and then exclude a lot of other people.
Yeah, I don't think communities are perfect or perfect solutions, and I think there's always a danger of communities closing themselves off, drawing new boundaries that won't let anybody else in, becoming self-righteous,
yeah,
right, about who they are.
Just to scrap Washington, D.C.
Becoming exclusive, right, all of that, absolutely. I mean, I think the democratic impulse within communities is constantly to turn over leadership, right, and to make sure that every community not only has definition, but a welcome mat, right? I mean, if those two things are paid attention to, it's another thing to learn about Holden, it seems to me. How you both define a community and keep the clear welcome mat out to make sure that it can constantly be, that breezes can blow through the window here, right? It's a tricky thing, and it's not something I think that we're born knowing. I mean, I think we may have to all sort of relearn our community building skills.
You have communication going in each direction.
Yeah.
So one group, you know, one of the fears I've heard of community policing too.
It's yeah. A
popular idea throughout the country.
Yes.
And I've seen other people who watch these things for 30 years
yeah.
and said, watch out for this neighborhood watch group. Their next thing they're going to go into is going to be zoning. The next thing they're going to do is in the Rockridge District of Oakland, keep out blacks, minorities,
yeah.
while at the same time saying they welcome them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's always a danger. I think that's always a danger. I think the alternative, however, to assume that communities therefore have no functions and that only institutions can solve our problems on an individual basis has simply exhausted itself.
Yeah.
We don't have the resources to go down that path any further. Right? Chuck and Natalia.
I was thinking as you were talking about the planet's map of rich and poor, where we have all kinds of indicators, quantifiable,
yeah.
Child mortality, we do it by nations.
Yes.
Child mortality, literacy rates, nutrition, various indicators, and instead of the South Bronx and the west side of Chicago, on that map at the bottom, the most needy are Bangladesh and
yeah.
Haiti and Mali and
yes.
Angola, Ethiopia, you've all got our list. And they have to play, it seems, much the same game. Their governments go to the World Bank and to individual nations and collections of donor nations for grants. And their community groups within those countries go to Lutheran World Relief
yeah.
and Church World Service and
yeah.
Dan Church Aid and North Church Aid and so forth. So there are a lot of parallels
yes.
that are fascinating. And it's almost as though the worst your diagnosis, your self-diagnosis is, the more you're likely to get funded.
Yeah,
same
absolutely.
In the global, too. But I see a couple differences. One is, I think there's an increasing recognition, at least in the church globally, that the glass of the spirit is fuller
yes.
in the poorer countries
yes.
than in the rich countries.
Yeah.
The donor countries are lacking in spirit.
Uh-huh.
And spirituality, however we define that. And the poorer countries and their communities tend to be much fuller, much richer. And also richer in community.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a genuine community. I know a lot of the voluntary organization
yes.
funding is most effective when it works with communities that do have a sense of who they are
yeah.
and what they're about, even if they're very poor.
Yeah.
And there is a recognition also that some of the indicators of health are not quantifiable.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the work that women do in those economies is not counted
right.
in the economic indicators
right.
because it's not part of it's barter or whatever it is, it's not part of the marketplace counting. So I see some parallels globally, but I also see some differences. And maybe some of those differences. Maybe it's true in North America too that in urban communities that are impoverished, there is at least more of the full glass of the spirit. I don't know.
Well, I think it's certainly arguable, Chuck.
Yeah.
Some of the more lively Sunday mornings I've never around are out in the
some of those churches are lively
in Chicago or
right
there.
That's right.
And I think there's also something clearly true about low-income city communities, that there is a kind of expectation of sharing that's about.